Well, like I said, it's our first Sunday night in 2017. The new year is usually a time that a lot of people decide that they want to make some new commitments in their life, maybe make some resolutions. How many of you actually made a New Year's resolution or a few resolutions this year, things that you wanted to change? Okay, we have one person here, a couple, okay, maybe two or three that actually have decided to make some changes to their life. You know, there are some people that just don't believe in resolutions. They think that, it's nobody ever keeps them. You know, they start it, and by the end of the first week, they've already blown it. For you three that actually set resolutions, how many of you have actually blown it already? You've already, so 1 week into it. Oh, you're not going to acknowledge that, right? You know, I don't think resolutions are such a terrible thing. I think the new year is a good time to maybe take some stock of what is going on in your life, to see maybe something that is out of whack, something that maybe you weren't so great at in this past year, particularly in your walk with the Lord, that you want to see God work in you. That's an awesome thing. And we should, from time to time, doesn't have to be the new year, to take a look at our life and see what is it that the Lord needs to work on in our life. Surely we can't do it ourselves. We need God's help. But making resolutions, whether it be in January or whether it be in June, I think is a really good thing. And I want to tell you a story about a man you may have heard of before. His name is Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards lived a few hundred years ago. He lived during the 18th century. But he was probably the greatest mind, greatest Christian mind that the United States of America has ever produced. He was a pastor and a theologian, but also a very dedicated man in his relationship with the Lord. And when he was only 19 years old, he sat down to write his own resolutions. This was not a New Year thing for him. It was a time in his life where he decided that he was going to make resolutions before God as to the type of person that he wanted to be, the certain way that he wanted to live. And over the course of some time, he wrote down 70 resolutions that he wanted to apply to his life in order to enhance his relationship with the Lord. Now, I'm surely not going to walk you through all 70 of those, but I want to share a few of them with you right now. A few of these resolutions that I think stuck out to me. Now, he wrote in, English was a little bit archaic. I'm not going to read it as he wrote them, but I want to share with you some that I've kind of, to the best of my ability, updated them in contemporary English. Now, he began before he even wrote down any of these resolutions by saying this: "Aware that I am unable to do anything without God's help, I do pray that, by His grace, He will enable me to keep these resolutions so far as they are in line with His will, and that they may honor Christ." His fourth resolution was this: "I will never do anything physically or spiritually except things that glorify God, and I will not gripe about having to do it." His 14th resolution: "I will never do anything out of revenge." The 28th: "I will study the Bible so often that it will become completely obvious that my knowledge of His Word has grown." His 34th resolution: "I will never speak anything that is not the absolute truth." Number 45, "I will not let any joy or sorrow or affection or circumstance get in the way of advancing the gospel." And then one more I'll share with you. Number 56, he said, "I will never give up or lighten up in my fight against sin in my life, no matter how successful or unsuccessful I might be." Now, I share those with you in part because I think making commitments to ourselves and making commitments to the Lord, and if you want to call them resolutions or call them something else, that is totally fine. I think that there are times in our life we need to do those very things. But this last one that I read to you in particular, he had this desire that he would get sin out of his life, that even in his fight against sin, if he were to fail and flounder, he would not give up in his pursuit of becoming more and more like Christ, which is exactly what the Lord wants us to do. He wants our lives to emulate his life. Now, I've told you to turn to James chapter 1, because we're going to look at a few verses here in James 1, where James talks about overcoming sin. He talks about the temptations that all of us face, and he describes to us the very way that temptation works in our life. And I think that we need to take to heart how that temptation does work. Because if you are a Christian, there's no doubt, whether you want to make it a resolution in your life or not, there's no doubt that what God wants to do is make you more like His Son. And so His Spirit is working in you to fashion you and to form you into the image of Christ. He wants to use His Word to instruct you so that you can avoid sin and learn how to walk in righteousness. And here in James chapter 1, He lays out for us how temptation works in our life. And if we know how temptation works, it will give us all the more power to avoid it. So follow along with me, beginning with verse 12. He says this, "Blessed is the man who endures temptation, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love Him. Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am tempted by God,' for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does He Himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good and every perfect gift comes from above," is a gift from, 17 again. "Every good and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning." And I'm going to pause right there. James is a very practical book, I want you to know. And what James is going to be laying out for us is some practical instruction in regards to how we ought to be living our Christian life. Now, I do want you to know this, is that when James is talking to us about avoiding sin, he is not describing to us how you ought to avoid sin in order to become a Christian. There's not a single one of us that can become a Christian by simply sinning less. That is not what he is trying to get across to us. What he is trying to do is instruct the believer. And if you have a relationship with Christ, you do have your sins forgiven, but we are in the process of learning how to sin less. So he's not describing how to become a Christian by sinning less. He's describing to us how, as a Christian, we ought to work at sinning less and less in our life. That's the practicality of it. But he begins in verse 12 with that word, blessed. Now, I'm sure if you've been to many sermons before, you have learned a little bit about the word blessed. And it simply means this, is that blessed describes a person who is genuinely happy. It's a person who has, because God has blessed their life, has an overwhelming joy that begins to flood their life. It's not a superficial, temporary happiness. It's something that goes down deep into their life. It's a true joy that God instills in the believer, which is an interesting thing to think about when you consider what James is saying. Blessed is the man who endures temptation. I want you to think about that for a second. Because temptation essentially is describing something that is very desirable for you. If something does not tempt you, it means you don't desire it. But if it does tempt you, it means it is something that you want, right? That's what makes it a temptation. So essentially what James is saying is blessed or genuinely happy is the person who does not do what they want to do. Now, on the surface, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us, does it? That doesn't sound right. Blessed is the one, or happy is the one, who is not doing what it is that they desire to do. We think that to be truly blessed or to be truly joyful is to do exactly what it is that you want to do. As long as I am getting my way, as long as I am doing what I want to do, I'm going to be a genuinely happy person. But I tell you what, the people that get exactly what it is that they want all of the time are often the most unhappy, miserable people that you will ever meet. You see, getting exactly what you want isn't the secret to happiness. Somehow we think that if I got everything that I really wanted, then my life would truly be full. I'd be genuinely happy. I'm telling you flat out right now, that is so not true. Happiness does not come from getting it your way or getting everything that you want. In fact, James essentially is telling us quite the opposite. It's not the person who gets everything that they want or gives in to every temptation that they come across. Rather, what he is telling us is this, is that the blessed one, the one who is genuinely happy, is the one who does not give in to those desires, in particular because those desires, those temptations, are contrary to the will of God. Why would not giving in to those temptations not truly make me joyful? I'll tell you, because temptation and giving into that temptation is like feeding a monster that does not go away. It simply gets bigger and he gets hungrier. And the more you feed it, the more he wants to eat. Instead, though, the blessed person is the one who decides to overcome that temptation in their life. You want to be blessed? James is telling us the secret of that is to overcome that temptation in our life. Now, there are those that are blessed because they don't give in to the temptation. But then there are those who blame. And that's what verse 13 tells us. There are those that blame the fact that they give in to those temptations on a multitude of things. In this verse, it names God being maybe the chief and foremost person that people will often blame. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God is not tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. God isn't tempting us to sin, but many people will say, if God didn't want me to live this way or give in to this, why did he put the desire in my heart? Almost like they are using it as an excuse, saying, God made me this way, so he can't fault me for living according to these impulses and doing these very things. We cannot blame God. God created us as beings that he wants us to follow after him. He wants us to honor him. He wants us to walk in his ways. I tell you who is causing the problems. The Bible calls him in 1 Thessalonians the tempter. And that is Satan himself. If we want to blame anybody for the temptations that we face, we ought to blame the devil. But we can't even say the devil made me do it, because verse 14 is going to go on and tell us who really is to blame when it comes to the temptations that we face. Look at what it says in verse 14. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Who do we blame for the fact that we are tempted and that we fall? It's our own desires. Is that right? That's what he's telling us. He's telling us that we are responsible for our own sins. You know, I don't know why it is, but it seems like we're living in a generation of people who do not want to accept personal responsibility for just about anything. It's not my fault. It's the way I was raised. It's not my fault. If you didn't do what you did to me, I wouldn't feel inclined to do what I did to you. And we blame shift, and it's always somebody else's responsibility or somebody else's fault. But what we're told here by James is that it is our own desires that causes this to happen. Here's the thing. Before you were a Christian, you lived by your sin nature. And you probably didn't even really think about temptation at all, because temptation wasn't a concern. If you were tempted, you just gave into that temptation. As far as you were concerned, there was no reason to resist that temptation. But then you gave your life to Christ. Jesus washes away all of your sin. You're now born again. His Spirit lives within you. Now you have this desire in you to follow after the Lord, but you still have that old sin nature within you that still wants to please itself, still wants to do its own thing. And so it tugs at you and it pulls at you, and that's why you still face those particular temptations. You have a desire for God, and you have a desire to satisfy yourself. There are times that the Spirit is working in your life and drawing you closer to the presence of God, and all you want to do is grow in your relationship with the Lord, walk in obedience, and resist temptation. And there's other times that temptation just seems so right. It seems so desirous. And you probably face that tug of war. In Galatians chapter 5, Paul talks about walking in the Spirit so that we don't gratify the lust of the flesh. But then he goes on and says, because the Spirit wars against the flesh, and the flesh wars against the Spirit. I don't know if you've ever sensed that battle within yourself, that there is this battle between the part of you that wants to honor God and the part of you that just wants to do its own thing. We all face, as believers, we all face that battle, that internal battle. But when we give into the temptation, it's because we have allowed our own desires or our sin nature to rule. We've given it place in our life. And I tell you what, sometimes we not only give into it because temptation comes our way, sometimes we actually go looking for it. I remember seeing a bumper sticker on a car once that said this, "And lead me not into temptation, for I will find it for myself." And there's a lot of people that do exactly that. It's not that temptation has to come their way. They're seeking it out themselves. But James here in this verse, verse 14, begins using some terms that relate to those that would hunt, those that would fish. And I want to draw this out because it's going to draw a very clear picture for us of how temptation works in our life. That term draws away. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away. That term drawn away was a term used in hunting to describe luring away prey, or luring prey into a trap, or maybe even setting out a decoy, like a hunter might set a decoy of a duck in the middle of a pond, because the purpose of that decoy is to attract other ducks to that pond so that they are within reach of that hunter to shoot and to kill and to capture. The picture literally is to draw them in so that they can be hunted, so that they can be killed, so that they could be devoured. That's the picture that he is drawing. But he also uses the word entice. Now, that word entice in the Greek language was a term that also referred to bait. Bait, whether the bait is in a trap or whether the bait is on a hook. I'm so grateful for my wife, I just want you to know. Because she watched me walk out on the stage and try and read the Bible without my glasses, and she realized right away that he's not going to be able to get through this because he can't see what it is that he is reading. So, honey, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Okay, now I can actually see what it is that I'm talking about. That word entice is a word that was descriptive of bait. I want you to imagine for a second a fisherman who goes to a lake whose desire is to catch his own dinner. The dinner is out there in the middle of the lake somewhere. So what does he have to do in order to get that dinner on his plate? He's got to put something in that lake that fish desires. Every fish in that lake is hungry. They spend nearly their entire existence looking for food in that lake. So what the fisherman does is he simply places in the lake what the fish is looking for. But in the middle of that enticement, in the middle of that bait, is something that the fish does not see. It's the hook. So that when the fish goes after the bait, thinking that he is getting exactly what he wants, he finds that he gets exactly what he does not want, and that is a hook in his jaw. And rather than getting dinner, he becomes dinner. That literally is the picture that is being drawn here by James. And Satan, I truly believe, is a master fisherman. Because what he does is places before us what it is that we desire. But he does not reveal the hook. He keeps the hook hidden so that it looks appetizing to us. I remember many years ago, I was actually on a backpack trip up in the Eastern Sierras. Me and my friends, we had hiked up to one of the higher elevation lakes. It was called Thousand Island Lake. It's a big, beautiful lake, and the water was in the section that we were camping next to was like crystal clear. You could see straight through the water. Well, I brought my fishing pole, so I decided to try my luck at it. And so I went on the shore, and I had tied on a lure, a fishing lure. It was very shiny. The whole point of the lure is once you get it in the water, you begin to reel in, that thing starts wiggling. And it's shiny, it's kind of flashy, and it's moving, and so it looks very attractive to the fish. Well, because the water was so clear, literally as I cast out, I saw a trout that began to follow my lure. And I watched him get closer and closer. And then he would swim away, but then he would still be desirous, and so he'd get a little bit closer. Now, it took me 3 casts to actually catch him. But each time I cast, he was more curious, and he was drawn in. And eventually, on that 3rd cast, he went for the strike. And instead of getting dinner, he became my dinner that night. But that's what Satan does. Satan is the master fisherman. He is the one who entices us with his bait, but all he is doing is playing upon what it is that we already desire. Remember, verse 14 says, we're tempted when we're drawn away by our own desires. So he places before us what we already desire. The thing is that not all of us desire the same things. There are some things that are very tempting for me that might not tempt you at all. But there is something else that is just completely gripping for you. It tempts you a lot, but I wouldn't think about that twice. So what Satan does is he finds what bait works on us in order to get us to fall. So just like a fish, I may use one lure for a period of time, but if I haven't gotten the fish's attention, within the first 5 or 10 minutes, I'm going to reel it in and I'm going to change it to a different lure, or maybe I'm going to try and use an actual bait like salmon eggs or like cheese or something like that, because that fish wants something. I just have to figure out what that fish wants. And I believe Satan does the same thing. He's going to place in front of you his bait. If you don't go for it, he changes bait. And he places something else in front of your eyes to see what it is that you're attracted to. And when he finds what it is that is your weak spot, he tends to go after it and go after it and go after it. Have you found that to be true in your life? Usually the sins that we fall into are the same sins over and over and over again, because that's what he has found works in our life. We're drawn away by our own desires, and we're enticed by the bait that he places before us. This is exactly what happened in the Garden of Eden. The very first sin of mankind followed this very formula. God had told Adam and Eve about the hook. He said, you can eat of any tree in the garden, except for this one tree. Do not eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because there is a hook in that. The hook is this: the day that you eat of it, you will surely die. So God told them there's a hook. But then the serpent comes to Eve. Did God really say that you shouldn't eat of any of the trees? The Lord knows that in the day that you eat of this tree, you will become like him, having knowledge of good and of evil. So essentially what he did is he came to Eve and said, Eve, there's no hook. God told you there's a hook, but there's no hook. You see, what God is doing is he's withholding something good from you. He has something that is good. He doesn't want you to have it. So he's told you, you can't have it. So then Eve turns her eyes to the tree. And she saw that it was good for food. And that it was pleasant to the eyes. And that it was desirable to make one wise. Three words that are in that one verse. Good, pleasant, desirable. And that's how Satan presented it. That was the bait. Eve, this is good. Eve, this is pleasant. Eve, this is desirable. She forgot about the hook. She took and ate. She gave it to her husband and they ate and they suddenly realized that the hook was there. They realized that they were naked. They began to hide themselves from God because the hook was set. They brought death into the world. Satan is crafty, but he doesn't have to be ingenuitive because the same formula works today as it did back then. And James is telling us exactly how that works. We're drawn away by our own desires and we're enticed by the bait that he presents before us because we either ignore the hook, we forget about the hook, and you know what? Sometimes he even doesn't have to use the bait to cover the hook. I remember once going fishing at Lake Powell in Utah. And I had been fishing for a while, and it seemed like every cast I was catching a fish. And it did not even take long. It was within seconds I was catching fish. And I was turned to my family, and I said, I don't even think I have to use bait. And so I decided to throw the hook out there with no bait on it at all. And within seconds, I caught another fish. They got worked up into a frenzy to the point where you didn't even need the bait. They were so adamant about getting to the hook before any of their buddies could get to the hook that they were literally fighting to be caught. And there are some people that Satan doesn't even have to hide the hook anymore. They're so addicted to the temptation that they go right for the hook. That's the source of our temptation. The source is our desire. Satan just plays on that desire. But then he tells us the course that sin will take in our life in verse 15. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. That word conceived can also be translated to seize or to grasp. It literally, in our context here, can be used in both describing the conception of birth as well as the seizing of the bait like the fish would do, grabbing a hold of the bait and then being hooked by it. Because the same Greek word is translated in both contexts. It does mean the conception of birth or the conception of a woman who would 9 months later give birth, but it also means to seize, like grabbing hold of the bait. And I don't think it's a coincidence that James is using this type of terminology because he shows the progression of exactly what happens in the life of the person who decides to give in to that temptation. When the desire has conceived, in other words, when they have clasped the hold of that temptation, they have given in to the enticement, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. Romans 6:23 tells us that the wages of sin is death. I want you to see, too, that the progression of what takes place here is just leading a person, really, to the slaughter. I remember years ago, and I'll never forget it, hearing Greg Laurie share something that I committed to memory because I thought it was so true. If you sow a thought, you will reap an act. If you sow an act, you will reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character, reap a destiny. It all begins with a thought in the mind, the temptation. But if we allow that temptation to mull over in our mind, it's only a matter of time before it will come out in an action. And if we allow that action to continue to be a part of our life, we develop a habit. And if we continue on in that habit, it becomes simply part of our character. And if it becomes part of our character, it becomes part of our destiny. What does James say that the destiny is? When sin is full grown, it brings forth death. Now, I want you to see a contrast that is here between what he began to say in verse 12 and what he says here in verse 15. Because in verse 12, he tells us that those who are blessed because they endure temptation will receive the crown of life. Those who give in to the temptation, according to verse 15, bring sin into their world, and when sin is full grown, it brings forth death. Resisting temptation, crown of life. Giving into the temptation, the wages of sin is death. And James lays it out in such a way that we have really the choice to make. If we resist, we are choosing the path of life. If we give in, we are choosing the path of death. I really believe that sin is a lot like fireworks. They're beautiful. They're exciting. But they're temporary. And once the pop is over, what you are left with is ashes and smoke. So enjoy it while you can, because it's not going to last very long. But because it is so temporary, and because the end of it is death, it's better to live the blessed life. And I want to share with you 5 ways that we as believers can resist the temptation. One of the ways is going to be mentioned here in our passage, but there are other verses in the New Testament that tell us how we can resist the temptation, get away from it, and overcome it in our life. And if you haven't been taking notes, this is the time to begin. I want to share these 5 principles with you. Every one of them is going to begin with the letter R, which will make it a little bit easier for us to remember. But these are the things that if you want to overcome temptation in your life, you need to remember these things. The first one is request help. What I mean by that is we need to pray. Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6, he in teaching his disciples to pray, included in the middle of the Lord's Prayer, "And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." So right there, he was instructing his disciples to pray that they would not fall into temptation. Now, later in Jesus' ministry, in fact, the night before he would be crucified, he was with his disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane. That was the time that he was praying, "Father, if there's any way for this cup to pass from me, let it be so, but not my will, your will be done." Remember, he returned to his disciples, and there they were asleep. And so he wakes them up and tells them, "Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation." So he was instructing them again that they ought to be praying in order to overcome the temptation. But this is the one thing I want you to understand about both of those teachings by Jesus, is that Jesus was not teaching them to pray in the moment of the temptation. He was instructing them to pray before the temptation was even faced. That's important, because deciding to pray that God is going to help you overcome the temptation in the middle of you being tempted is almost like deciding to put the parachute on after you've jumped out of the plane. You should have thought of that before. And the Lord was really instructing his men to be prayed up. Be prayed up, asking God, request God for help. "Lord, strengthen me that I would not fall into temptation." That's number one, request help. The second one is remember. Remember what? I want you to remember what he says here in verse 17. It was the last verse that we read. "Every good and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning." What he is telling us here is this, is that everything that is good comes from who? comes from the Father himself, comes from God. That means anything that God has not said is okay, anything that God in the Bible forbids, it's not a good thing, because he will not withhold from you any good thing. So we need to remember, anytime that we are tempted by something that for us looks good, we need to understand, but God promised that he's not going to withhold anything good from me. And if God says that this is wrong, then there's a hook in there somewhere. I don't see it. It looks appetizing, but I'm going to avoid it, because if it was truly good, the Father would have given it to me. So we request help. We remember the promise of God that he does not withhold anything good from us. The third is that, this is a combination of ours, is that we need to recognize and resist. Recognize what? We need to recognize where that temptation is truly coming from. In 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, we're told this: be sober, be vigilant. For your adversary, the devil, is prowling around like a lion, seeking whom he may devour. Therefore, resist him steadfast in the faith. In other words, when you are tempted, recognize where that temptation is coming from, and then resist it. That means to stand up against it. When you recognize where it is coming from, it gives you the strength to say, no, I'm not going to give in to that, because I know the source of that, and that source is not from God. That source is from the devil himself. But you might say to yourself, but see, that's my problem. Resisting is exactly what my problem is. When I'm tempted, I have a hard time resisting. That brings us to number four, and that is run. You run away. Just like Joseph did way back in the book of Genesis when Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him. And not just one time, but several times came to him trying to seduce him, trying to coax him into lying with her. Eventually, the time came where he literally ran from her presence in the attempt to get away from that tempting situation. And you know, the Bible tells us that God will always provide for us a way of escape. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13. No temptation has seized you except that which is common to man. But God is faithful and will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able. But with the temptation will always provide a way of escape that you may bear up under it. God gives us the promise. Anytime that you are tempted, I am always providing a back door to get out. There's always a way of escape. And so the fourth one is you just simply take that way of escape. You run for your life. The last one, the fifth one is this, is that you are to remove yourself from tempting situations. Remove yourself. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 33, we're told, don't be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals or good habits. Sometimes the very fact that we are being tempted is because we have placed ourselves in the path of those temptations. We're hanging around the people that try and drag us into those very temptations. We go to the places where those temptations exist. So what it's describing to us is basically this, is that you keep yourself away from the very spots that are going to be the problem for you. So those five things. Request help. Just pray beforehand, not in the moment. Although praying in the moment is a latch-dish effort, you should be praying in advance, saying, God, I know today temptation is going to come my way. There's going to be things that are going to try and lure me into the trap. Strengthen me so that I can stand. The second one, remember that God supplies all good things. And if God hasn't given the okay, then it really is not a good thing. The third, remember where it does come from, the source, Satan himself, and resist him steadfast in the faith. And then run. If you don't feel like you can resist, you simply run for your life. And then finally, you Remove yourself. Remove yourself from the very situation where that temptation might face you. There's a Christian band that had, I don't think that they're around anymore. They were back in the 90s. Their name was Everybody Duck. But they had a great song that was called Susie's Diet. And I want to read you some of the lyrics of this song because it really describes to you what I mean by how we ought to resist temptation. Susie has decided that it's time to lose some weight. So she's resolved to choose with caution just what foods go on her plate. She bought chocolate milkshake powder that she drinks 3 times a day. And once a week, a piece of frozen diet cheesecake is okay. But despite all of her efforts, Susie's weight just won't go away. Because she works 30 hours a week at Sam's all-you-can-eat buffet. Well, I live my life just like Susie's diet. I surround myself with things I vowed to give up, and I like it. Yes, I live my life just like Susie's diet. I tell myself that I should quit, but with it all around, I just can't help but try it. Susie's biggest problem was that she just couldn't see. She put herself in situations where she'd be tempted easily. If we choose to live our lives the way the Bible says we should, we must clean out all that tempts us and surround ourselves with good. Because bad company corrupts good morals, and it's a proven fact. Honesty within herself is all that Susie truly lacked. Do you live your life just like Susie's diet? Do you surround yourself with things that tempt you, and do you like it? Do you live your life just like Susie's diet? If you're still playing with your sin, you just might fool yourself, but God's not going to buy it. One of my favorite hymns is Come Thou Fountain. Because in the midst of this hymn, there's a tremendous amount of honesty that I think sometimes is absent in some worship songs. You know, we sing songs like I Surrender All, and I always feel like I can't even say that because am I truly surrendering all? Or should I be saying I surrender some, or I surrender most, or I'm trying to surrender more, or, you know, something like that. But to say I surrender all, I just don't feel that maybe I'm always being truthful. But this is a hymn, Come Thou Fount, that has a stanza in it that the author of the hymn really was bearing the truth of what he felt inside. And this is what he said. Oh, to grace, how great a debtor daily I'm constrained to be. Let thy goodness, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, Lord. Take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. Love that. Because it's a Christian man knowing his own struggle, saying, God, I feel this inside of me. There are times that I want to do it my way, not your way. I want to go my direction, not your direction. I feel that tendency to wander away from you. So, Lord, take my heart. Take it, Lord, and seal it for you. And maybe that can be your prayer as well. You know, we're entering into a new year, a time that we oftentimes make the decision. You know what, Lord, this year is going to be the year that I'm really going to turn things around. I'll tell you first and foremost, you're not going to do that yourself. You can try all you want to fix your own life. Only God can fix you. And you sinning less this year is not going to make you a Christian. Becoming a Christian is all about what Jesus did for you by giving His life, not by you trying to sin less. But if you are a Christian, if you have given your life to Him, He does want you to sin less. And if His Spirit is alive in you, you have the desire to sin less. So how do you sin less? Pray for His help. Remember, everything good comes from Him. Recognize that if temptation comes your way, but it's something that God has forbidden, recognize that the source is not God, it's Satan himself. Resist him. And if you have to, run. And avoid every place or people that you know are a problem for you. And you'll see that God's going to begin to give you victory. Let's pray.